understanding, and he who is vigilant on her account will soon be free from care, because she goes about seeking those worthy of her, and she graciously appears to them in their paths and meets them in every thought. The beginning of wisdom is the most sincere desire for instruction, and concern for instruction is love of her. And love of her is the keeping of her laws. And giving heed to her laws is assurance of immortality. And immortality brings one near to God. So the desire for wisdom leads to a kingdom. Wisdom of Solomon of the Apocrypha, 6:12-20. Also, therefore I prayed, and understanding was given me. I called upon God, and the spirit of wisdom came to me. I preferred her to scepters and thrones, and I accounted wealth as nothing in comparison with her. Neither did I liken to her any priceless gem, because all gold is but a little sand in her sight, and silver will be accounted as clay before her. I loved her more than health and beauty, and I chose to have her rather than light, because her radiance never ceases. All good things came to me along with her, and in her hands uncounted wealth. I rejoiced in them all because wisdom leads them, but I did not know that she was their mother. I learned without guile, and I impart without grudging. I do not hide her wealth, for it is an unfailing treasure for men. Those who get it obtain friendship with God, commended for the gifts that come from instruction. May God grant that I speak with judgment and have thought worthy of what I have received, for he is the guide even of wisdom and the corrector of the wise. Wisdom 7:7-15. Wisdom may be personified as a spirit who eternally gives, who provides to her adherents unfailing riches. She is to be valued higher than status or material possessions, as the source of all things. With the categorical inexactitude characteristic of metaphoric thought and its attendant richness of connotation, the act of valuing this spirit is also wisdom. So the matrix itself becomes conflated with, that is, grouped into the same category as, the attitude that makes of that matrix something beneficial. This conflation occurs because primal generative capacity characterizes both the source of all things and the exploratory slash hopeful attitudes and actions that make of that source determinate things. We would only regard the latter, the subjective stance, as something clearly psychological, as something akin to wisdom in the modern sense. The former is more likely to be considered external from our perspective, something beyond subjective intervention. But it is the case that without the appropriate attitude, the unknown is a sterile wasteland. Ask, and it shall be given you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. For every one that asketh, receiveth, and he that seeketh, findeth. And to him that knocketh, it shall be opened. Matthew 7:7-8. Expectation and faith determine the response of the unknown, as courageous approach eliminates anticipatory anxiety, and exploration makes the unexpected something valuable. So the indiscriminate categorization characterizing these passages has its worth. We are motivated to protect the products of our exploration, our familiar territories, because unexplored phenomena are intrinsically meaningful. And that meaning is apt to show itself as threat. The probability that the meaning of unexplored territory will be threat, however, appears to be a function of the interpretive context within which it makes its appearance. If the unknown is approached voluntarily, which is to say, as if it is beneficial, then its promising aspect is likely to appear more salient. If the unknown makes its appearance despite our desire, then it is likely to appear more purely in its aspect of threat. This means that if we are willing to admit to the existence of those things that we do not understand, those things are more likely to adopt a positive face. Rejection of the unknown, conversely, increases the likelihood that it will wear a terrifying visage when it inevitably manifests itself. It seems to me that this is one of the essential messages of the New Testament, with its express, although difficult to interpret, insistence that God should be regarded as all good. The beneficial aspect of the unknown is something unavailable to the unworthy, something eternal and pure, something that enters into relationship with those who are willing from age to age, and something that makes a friend of God. The unknown is also something that may be conceptualized using sexual symbolism, something that may be known in the biblical sense. Joined with us, as with a bride, she produces all things that are good. I learned both what is secret and what is manifest. For wisdom, the fashioner of all things, taught me. For in her there is a spirit that is intelligent, holy, unique, manifold, subtle, mobile, clear, unpolluted, distinct, invulnerable, loving the good, keen, irresistible, beneficent, humane, steadfast, sure, free from anxiety, all-powerful, overseeing all, and penetrating through all spirits that are intelligent and pure and most subtle. For wisdom is more mobile than any motion. Because of her pureness, she pervades and penetrates all things. For she is a breath of the power of God and a pure emanation of the glory of the Almighty. Therefore, nothing defiled gains entrance into her. For she is a reflection of eternal light, a spotless mirror of the working of God and an image of His goodness. Though she is but one, she can do all things, and while remaining in herself, she renews all things. In every generation she passes into holy souls and makes them friends of God and prophets. For God loves nothing so much as the man who lives with wisdom. For she is more beautiful than the sun and excels every constellation of the stars. Compared with the light, she is found to be superior, for it is succeeded by the night. But against wisdom, evil does not prevail. She reaches mightily from one end of the earth to the other, and she orders all things well. I loved her and sought her from my youth, and I desired to take her for my bride, and I became enamored of her beauty. She glorifies her noble birth by living with God, and the Lord of all loves her. For she is an initiate in the knowledge of God, and an associate in His works. If riches are a desirable possession in life, what is richer than wisdom, who effects all things? And if understanding is effective, who more than she is fashioner of what exists? Wisdom 7:22-8:6. The terrible unknown compels representation. Likewise, the beneficial unknown. We are driven to represent the fact that possibility resides in every uncertain event, that promise beckons from the depths of every mystery. Transformation, attendant upon the emergence of change, means the death of everything old and decayed, means the death of everything whose continued existence would merely mean additional suffering on the part of those still striving to survive. The terrible unknown, which paralyzes when it appears, is also succor for the suffering, calm for the troubled, peace for the warrior, insight and discovery for the perplexed and curious. Is the redemptive jewel in the head of the toad or in the lair of the fire-belching dragon? The unknown is the fire that burns and protects, the endlessly mysterious transcendent object that simultaneously gives and takes away. The positive aspect of the unknown, incarnated as the many-breasted Greco-Roman goddess Diana or Artemis, mistress of the animals, is portrayed in Figure 35, unexplored territory as creative mother. Everything that contains, shelters, and produces exists as source for the symbolic representation of, occupies the same category as, this promising element. Fruit, distinctive for its seed-bearing properties, such as the pomegranate or poppy, provides appropriate motif for gravid containment. The pig stands as representative of fertility, and the cow, the holy beast of India, as embodiment of principle of nourishment. Shellfish stand for generation and fertility because of their vulva-like shape. Inanimate items such as boxes, sacks, and troughs contain and shelter, while similar objects such as the bed, the cradle, and the nest are characterized by protective and therefore maternal function. Humanized representations, statuettes of nude goddesses, among the most ancient objects of representation known, appear to represent fecundity and the productive countenance of nature in anthropomorphic form. The creation and subsequent appreciation of such figures perhaps aided individuals and societies in their efforts to clarify the nature of the human relationship to the protective aspect of existence. Makers of such statuettes placed great emphasis on collective, impersonal features of generation, such as breasts, genitals, and hips, features whose functions remain largely outside voluntary control, but devoted little attention to features defining self-conscious individuality, like those of the face. Such figures apparently represented the vessel of life and were rendered in the image of woman, whose body generated human life and nourishment for that life. The body vessel represented beneficial nature itself, as stated by Neumann. All the basic vital functions occur in this vessel-body schema, whose inside is an unknown. Its entrance and exit zones are of special significance. Food and drink are put into this unknown vessel, while in all creative functions, from the elimination of waste and the emission of seed to the giving forth of breath and the word, something is born out of it. All body openings, eyes, ears, nose, mouth, navel, rectum, genital zone, as well as the skin, have, as places of exchange between inside and outside, a numinous accent for early man. They are, therefore, distinguished as ornamental and protected zones, and in man's artistic self-representation, they play a special role as idols. The unknown source of all determinate information is simultaneously destructive and creative. The terrible aspect of the Great Mother threatens everything with dissolution. Her positive sister is the generative aspect of being. Figure 36, the heavenly genealogy of the destructive and creative mothers, portrays the relationship between the two discriminable sisters, their derivation from the unified but ambivalent unknown, and their ultimate descent from the dragon of chaos. The ability to restrict the appearance of the terrible mother and foster the realization of her benevolent sister, that is, the ability to decrease threat and maximize promise and satisfaction, might well be regarded as the secret of successful adaptation. The existence of representations of the twin aspects of the unknown allowed for practice in adaptation in the face of such representations, allowed for exposure of the individual in imagination and action, in controlled fashion, to potently constructed representations of those things that he or she was destined to fear most, was necessarily most vulnerable to, but which could not be forever avoided. Similar rituals underlie every form of successful modern psychotherapy. Modern treatment for disorders of anxiety, to take a specific example, desensitization, involves exposing an individual ritualistically, that is, under circumstances rendered predictable by authority, to novel or otherwise threatening stimuli with appropriate reaction modeled by that authority. Such desensitization theoretically induces habituation. What is actually happening is that guided exploration in the course of behavior therapy produces reclassification and behavioral adjustment. such that the once terrifying thing, or once again terrifying thing, is turned back into something controllable, familiar, and known. Voluntary exposure additionally teaches the previously anxiety-ridden individual the non-trivial lesson that he or she is capable of facing the place of fear and prevailing. The process of guided voluntary exposure appears to produce therapeutic benefits even when the thing being avoided is traumatic. When it might appear cruel from a superficially empathic perspective to insist upon exposure and processing. The ritual of voluntary exposure fosters mimetic identification with the hero, whether this is explicitly recognized or not, teaches the individual that the courageous exploratory spirit can eternally prevail over threat. It is this mimetic identification and its abstracted equivalents and consequences that account for the increased general confidence and capabilities that tend to accompany exposure training. The reclassification and behavioral adjustment attendant upon therapeutic exposure places the previously terrible forces of the unknown back under the dominion of knowledge, into the domain of the known, expands explored territory into chaos, places the Great Mother under the strictures of her consort, culture, the Great Father. This is exploration-predicated creation of the cosmos from the pre-cosmogonic chaos, and the fostering of implicit identification with the Logos, the creative and redemptive word. Analysis of the much more dramatic, very widespread, but metaphorically equivalent phenomena of the sacrificial ritual, a rite whose very existence compelled one insightful author, Arthur Koestler, to argue for the essential insanity of man, provides additional insight into the nature of the ability to transform threat into promise. We have already discussed the fact that the valence of an object switches with context of interpretation. It is knowledge of this idea that allows for comprehension of the meaning of the sacrificial attitude. The beautiful countenance of the beneficial mother is the face the unknown adopts when approached from the proper perspective. Everything unknown is simultaneously horrifying and promising. It is courage and genius and the grace of God that determines which aspect dominates. The uncontrollable strength and bloodlust of the bull is the power which, when domesticated, serves to foster, protect, and engender the herd. The devastating power of sudden explosive combustion is reliable and efficient transportation when appropriately harnessed. The Gorgon of nature is helpmistress when approached by the brave, the honest, and the humble. Primary religious rituals, serving a key adaptive purpose, predicated upon knowledge of proper approach mechanisms, evolve to suit the space surrounding the primary deity, embodiment of the unknown. The ubiquitous drama of human sacrifice, prototypical of primordial religious practice, enacted the idea that the essence of man was something to be offered up voluntarily to the ravages of nature, something to be juxtaposed into creative encounter with the terrible unknown. The offering, in ritual, was often devoured, in reality or symbolically, as aid to embodiment of the immortal human spirit, as aid to incorporation of the heroic process. Such rituals were abstracted and altered as they developed, with the nature of the sacrificial entity changing, with constancy of underlying ideation. As late as 1871 in India, the festival honoring the Great Mother in the guise of Durga or Kali was accompanied by the daily slaughter of 20 buffalo, 250 goats, and 250 pigs. The blood-drenched sand in the sacrificial pits was replaced twice a day, removed and buried in the earth to ensure fertility. The slaughter of animals is a relatively late development from the psychohistorical viewpoint, and is generally preceded by, and stands in place of, the ritual sacrifice of human victims. The Indologist Heinrich Zimmer states, "In her hideous aspect, the goddess as Kali, the Dark One, raises the skull full of seething blood to her lips. Her devotional image shows her dressed in blood red, standing in a boat floating on a sea of blood. In the midst of the life flood, the sacrificial sap, which she requires that she may, in her gracious manifestation as the World Mother, bestow existence upon new living forms in a process of unceasing procreation, that as world nurse she may suckle them at her breasts and give them the food that is full of nourishment." An ancient conception, extending back as far as the Stone Age. Nature must at every step be given a helping hand. Even she can accomplish nothing by herself. She is no more self-sufficient than man. Nothing takes place of itself, either in the cosmos or in human beings. Man must perform clamorous rites in order to liberate the moon from the clutches of the eclipse, to dispel its demons. And if the sun is to be released from its winter feebleness and rise ever higher with the rising year, a young girl symbolizing the sun must swing higher and higher into the sky. In order to bear fruit and nurture life, the Earth Mother demands to be fertilized and strengthened by potations of blood, the vital fluid. The mysterious and seemingly irrational sacrificial ritual actually dramatizes or acts out two critically important and related ideas. First, that the essence of man, that is, the divine aspect, must constantly be offered up to the unknown, must present itself voluntarily to the destructive creative power that constitutes the Great Mother, incarnation of the unpredictable, as we have seen. And second, that the thing that is loved best must be destroyed, that is, sacrificed, in order for the positive aspect of the unknown to manifest itself. The former idea is predicated on the notion that the unknown must be encountered voluntarily for new information to be generated, for new behavioral patterns to be constructed. The latter idea is predicated on the observation that an improper or outdated or otherwise invalid attachment, such as the attachment to an inappropriate pattern of behavior or belief, turns the world into waste by interfering with the process of adaptation itself. Rigid, inflexible attachment to inappropriate things of value, indicative of dominance by a pathological hierarchy of values, a dead god, is tantamount to denial of the hero. Someone miserable and useless in the midst of plenty, just for the sake of illustration, is unhappy because of his or her attachments to the wrong things. Unhappiness is frequently the consequence of immature or rigid thinking, a consequence of the overvaluation of phenomena that are, in fact, trivial. The neurotic clings to the things that make her unhappy, while devaluing the processes, opportunities, and ideas that would free her if she adopted them. The sacrifice of the thing loved best to appease the gods is the embodiment in procedure of the idea that the benevolent aspect of the unknown will return if the present schema of adaptation, the ruling king, is sufficiently altered, that is, destroyed and regenerated. An individual stripped of his identification with what he previously valued is simultaneously someone facing the unknown, and is, therefore, someone unconsciously imitating the hero. The voluntary stripping of such identity makes the supplicant into a new man, at least if the sacrifice was genuine. This is not to say that such ideas cannot degenerate into meaningless, empty, and cruel ritual. The intimate relationship between clinging to the past, rejection of heroism, and denial of the unknown is most frequently explicated in narrative form. Perhaps because the association is so complex that it has not yet been made explicit. The following fairy tale, a wake-up call from the psychoanalytic unconscious, may serve as useful exemplar. It occurred spontaneously to me in a single piece while I was trying to help a man I knew who was undergoing a psychological crisis. His attachment to the unnecessary and superfluous was putting his future in serious danger. But he would not admit this. I wanted to warn him that he would eventually pay a great price for his short-sightedness. He ignored the story, however, at least in the short term, with predictable results. Cock-a-doodle-doo. Once upon a time, there was a man who had a long, hard journey ahead of him. He was trudging along the way, over the boulders and through the brushes, when he saw a little shiny gnome with big white teeth and a black toupee sitting by the side of the road. He was drumming on a log with two white bones and humming oddly to himself. The little gnome said, "John, why work so hard? Why walk so fast? Who knows if you'll ever get there anyway? Come over here. I have something to show you." So John walked off the road. He was sick of walking anyhow, because people kept throwing sticks and stones at him. The little gnome said, "I have a shiny red jewel I would like to sell you. Cheap. Here it is." And from beneath his cloak he pulled the biggest ruby that the man had ever seen. It must have weighed 100 pounds, and it shone like the sun. The gnome said, "Do you like it? It is an enchanted stone. What will you offer me for it?" And the man said, "I don't have much money, but I will give you everything I have." The gnome looked displeased, so John added, "I could pay some more monthly." So the gnome accepted. "Fair enough. Buy now, pay later. Sounds good to me. I'm all for the installment plan." So the man gave the gnome all his money and promised to pay the rest later. And the gnome walked back into the bush by the road, clacking his teeth and giggling and twitching. The more the man thought about his ruby and the great deal he got, the happier he became. He started back on the road with a light heart, but soon discovered that he couldn't make much progress, because 100 pounds was a lot to carry. He said to himself, "Why continue anyway? I have what I want. Why don't I just stand here holding my ruby? And when people walk by, they can see how well I have already done." So he stopped. A little while later, one of his friends came along and saw him standing there. His friend said, "John, why don't you come along with me? I have just opened a new business, and I could really use some help. Come along, quick. It will be opening soon." John thought that sounded good, but his friend was in a hurry. Besides, couldn't he see the ruby? How could he speed along beside him? Where would he put his jewel? So he said, "Thanks, but I have to take care of my jewel. Maybe I'll see you later." His friend looked at him like he was crazy, but he was trying to get somewhere quick. So he just shrugged a bit and said, "Okay, John, see you later," and he sped on down the road. A little while later, another friend came by, and he said, "John, nice to see you. I am going back to school. There are lots of wonderful things to learn, lots of great things to do. The world is full of unsolved problems. I could use some company. Would you like to come along?" John thought that sounded pretty good. But this friend, too, looked like he was in a hurry. Besides, standing beside the road holding the jewel was tiring, and he needed all the energy he had for that. So he said to his friend, "Thanks, but I have to take care of my jewel. Isn't it beautiful? Maybe I'll see you later." His friend looked at him like he was crazy, but he was trying to get somewhere quick, so he just shrugged and said, "Hope everything goes all right with you. See you later." Many friends came and went, and the years went by. The jewel got heavier and heavier, but the man got more and more attached to it. The only thing was, nobody seemed to notice how beautiful it was. People would rush by and talk about their plans. And nobody had a ruby as big, and nobody seemed likely to get a ruby as big. So you'd think that someone might have said something. Something at least like, "Nice ruby, John. Sure wish I had one like that." But it never happened. Then one day, someone new came down the road. He was bent over, and he was thin, and his hair was gray, although he did not look that old. He was carrying a big, dirty rock carefully in his arms, and he was not making much progress. The strange figure approached and glanced up at John. Then he grinned and said, "Why are you standing there stupidly with a big, ugly rock in your tired old hands? You look pretty daft. I bet you wish you had a big ruby like the one I am carrying." And John thought, "This poor man is deluded. He is carrying a rock. It is I who have the ruby." So he said, "Excuse me, sir, but you are sadly mistaken. I am the one with the jewel. I met a little gnome by the side of the road, and he sold it to me. I am still paying for it, although not so very much. You are carrying a rock." The tired stranger looked annoyed. He said, "I don't know what game you are playing, mister. You have a rock. I have a jewel. The little gnome you described sold it to me, and he said it was the only one. I have been carrying it for 20 years, and I will never let it go." And John said, "But I have been carrying mine for 20 years, too. It can't be just a rock." Rock or jewel? On and on they argued. Suddenly, out stepped the little gnome, as if he had never left. Only this time he wasn't so little. He was bigger and redder and menacing, and his laugh sounded like the rattling of chains. "Quit arguing, you two. I've never seen a sight quite so pathetic. You're carrying rocks, both of you, and if you ever would have had the sense to put them down for a second or two, you would have seen that." "Oh, well, at least you were diligent, and I played a mean trick. I feel bad. So I'm going to give you what you really deserve." "Do you want what you really deserve?" And John and the thin stranger nodded eagerly. Finally, they thought. "You haven't seen anything yet. Throw down your rocks." So John and the thin stranger obeyed. Each rock split down the middle when it hit the ground. Out flowed a river of ravenous white worms, which rushed toward the men and devoured them whole, while they thrashed about and screamed. Soon, nothing was left except a leg bone from each. The little gnome picked them up and walked off the road. He sat down by a hollow log and started to drum. He drummed, and he waited, and he hummed an odd little tune. "Pitcher of food feeds the whole hungry clan. The image of good makes the whole healthy man. Why walk the mile? Why do the work? Just smile the smile. Success, after all, is a quirk. Life isn't real. That's the message I give. It's easy that way. Plus, who wants to live?" It is ideas of the necessity of sacrifice that underlie, for example, the well-known but explicitly incomprehensible ritual of Christian communion. More accurately, the ritual of the Christian communion serves as one behavioral precursor for these explicit ideas. The Christian hero, Christ, is the spirit who offers himself voluntarily to the cross, to the grave, to suffering and death, to the terrible mother. Such a spirit is, above all, humble, which is a very paradoxical term in this context. Arrogance is belief in personal omniscience. Heroic humility, set against such arrogance, means recognition of constant personal error, conjoined with belief in the ability to transcend that error, to face the unknown, and to update fallible belief in consequence. Humble therefore means greater than dogma. As the spirit of man is a higher power than the laws which govern his behavior. Christ's body, represented in the communion ritual by the ever-resurrecting wheaten wafer, is the container of the incarnate spirit of the dying, reborn, and redemptive deity. This body is ritually devoured, that is, incorporated, to aid the ritual participants in their identification with Christ, the eternally dying and resurrecting Son God. Construction of this awful ritual meant furtherance of the abstract conceptualization of a permanent structural aspect of every human psyche, the heroic aspect, the Word, as active, individually doomed yet mythically eternal, destined to tragic contact with threat and promise of unknown, yet constant participant in the creative, adaptive, redemptive process. The ritual act of exposure is held simultaneously to placate or minimize the cruel aspect of nature and to allow for establishment of contact with the beneficent. From the modern perspective, it might be said, much more abstractly, that voluntary, cautious, careful, exploratory encounter with the threatening and unknown constitutes the precondition for transformation of that unknown into the promising, or at least the mundane, as a consequence of shift in behavior or interpretation. We moderns interpret this change in experience as alteration in subjective state. The pre-experimental mind, less capable of clearly differentiating subject from object, more concerned with the motivational significance of the experience, observes instead that the fear-inducing character of the object has receded as a consequence of the courage of the explorer or the benevolence of the thing in question. Ritual sacrifice was an early, pre-abstract behavioral variant of the idea of heroism, of belief in individual power. The acting out of the idea that voluntary exposure to the unknown, or dissolution of the most favored thing, constituted a necessary precondition, one, for the emergence of the beneficial goddess, and two, for continued successful adaptation. Incorporation of the sacrificial individual in actuality, in ritual cannibalism, or in religious ceremony, in the Mass, for example, meant assimilation of the culture hero. Such incorporation was a pre-conscious attempt to embody the heroic essence, to fortify the constituent elements of the community against paralyzing fear of death and darkness, to fortify the individual and the social group against fear of the unknown itself. The sacrificial ritual was acting out of the hero before such acting out could be represented in abstraction, in drama, in story. More abstract narrative representation of the target of the heroic sacrifice then came to portray the emergence of the beneficent goddess capable of showering reward upon man, her eternal lover and child. The spirit forever willing to risk personal, more abstractly, intrapsychic, destruction to gain redemptive knowledge might be considered the archetypal representative of the adaptive process as such. The pre-experimental mind considered traumatic union of this masculine representative with the destructive and procreative feminine unknown a necessary precedent to continual renewal and rebirth of the individual and community. This is an idea precisely as magnificent as that contained in the Osiris-Horus myth, an idea which adds additional depth to the brilliant moral hypotheses contained in that myth. The exploratory hero, divine son of the known and unknown, courageously faces the unknown, unites with it creatively, abandoning all pretense of pre-existent absolute knowledge, garners new information, returns to the community, and revitalizes his tradition. It is to this more complete story, that we now turn our attention. The Divine Son, images of the knower, the exploratory process. Awake, awake. Put on strength, O arm of the Lord. Awake, as in the ancient days, in the generations of old. Art thou not it that hath cut Rahab and wounded the dragon? Isaiah 51:9. The great androgynous dragon of chaos is also the mythic figure who guards a great treasure hidden in the depths of a mountain, or who conceals a virgin princess in his lair. He is the fire-breathing winged serpent of transformation, the undescribable union of everything now discriminated, who constantly schemes to take back what he produced. The great and terrible mother, daughter of chaos, destroys those who approach her accidentally, incautiously, or with the inappropriate attitude, but showers upon those who love her and who act appropriately all good things. The great and terrible father, son of chaos, gives rise to sons of his own, but then attempts to crush or even to devour them. He is preconditioned for existence, but impediment to its successful elaboration. What might possibly constitute the appropriate pattern of action in the face of such permanent and multifarious contradiction? The fundamental act of creativity in the human realm, in the concrete case, is the construction of a pattern of behavior which produces emotionally desirable results in a situation that previously reeked of unpredictability, danger, and promise. Creative acts, despite their unique particulars, have an eternally identifiable structure because they always take place under the same conditions. What is known is extracted eternally from the unknown. In consequence, it is perpetually possible to derive and rederive the central features of the meta-pattern of behavior, which always and necessarily means human advancement. Human beings are curious about the structure and function of everything, not least themselves. Our capacity to tell stories reflects our ability to describe ourselves. It has been said that Freud merely recapitulated Shakespeare. But it was Freud's genius, despite his manifold errors, to bring what Shakespeare portrayed dramatically up one level of abstraction toward the philosophical or even the empirical. Freud moved information about behavior from the implicit narrative to the explicit theory, or at least to the more explicit theory. Shakespeare performed a similar maneuver, like all storytellers, at a more basic level. He abstracted from what was still behavioral, from what had not even yet been captured effectively in drama. During exploration, behavior and representational schema are modified in an experimental fashion, in the hopes of bringing about, by ingenious means, whatever outcome is currently envisioned. Such exploration also produces alteration of the sensory world, since that world changes with shift in motor output and physical locale. Exploration produces transformation in assumption-guiding behavior and an expectation of behavioral outcome, produces learning in knowing how and knowing what mode. Most generally, new learning means the application of a new means to the same end, which means that the pattern of presumptions underlying the internal model of the present and the desired future remain essentially intact. This form of readaptation might be described as normal creativity, and constitutes the bulk of human thought. However, on rare occasions, ongoing activity, specifically goal-directed or exploratory, produces more profound and unsettling mismatch. This is more stressful and more promising, and necessitates more radical update of modeling, necessitates exploration-guided reprogramming of fundamental behavioral assumption and associated episodic or semantic representation. Such reprogramming also constitutes creativity, but of the revolutionary type generally associated with genius. Exploration is therefore creation and recreation of the world. The generation of new information from contact with the unknown means the construction of experience itself. The destruction of previous modes of adaptation and representation, previous worlds, means return of explored territory to the unexplored condition that preceded it, and then its restructuring in more comprehensive form. This is encounter with the great and terrible mother, and death and resurrection of the son and the father. A new manner of dealing with, that is, behaving with regard to, or classifying, an emergent unknown, is the gift of the hero. This gift demands to be given, compels communication, either directly, say in the form of immediate imitation, or indirectly, in the form of abstract description or narrative. There is no real qualitative distinction between transformation of means and transformation of ends, as we have seen. What constitutes ends at a lower level of analysis becomes means at a higher level. It follows that the gift of the hero constitutes normal and revolutionary adaptation simultaneously. Normal adaptation, as schemas of action and representation are extended such that the unknown is rendered beneficial. Revolution, as the old is restructured to allow place for the new. This restructuring is equivalent to the establishment of peace, the peace characterizing the mythic paradise where the lion lays down with the lamb. Such peace emerges as a consequence of the hierarchical organization of the gods of tradition under the dominion of the hero. This means that the creative exploratory hero is also peacemaker in his complete manifestation. I dreamed that I was standing in the grassy yard of a stone cathedral on a bright, sunny day. The yard was unblemished, a large, well-kept green expanse. As I stood there, I saw a slab of grass pull back under the earth like a sliding door. Underneath the door was a rectangular hole that was clearly a grave. I was standing on an ancient graveyard whose existence had been forgotten. A medieval king dressed in solid armor rose out of the grave and stood at attention at the head of his burial site. Similar slabs slid back one after another in numerous places. Out of each rose a king, each from a different period of time. The kings were all powerful in their own right. Now, however, they occupied the same territory. They became concerned that they would fight, and they asked me how this might be prevented. I told them the meaning of the Christian wedding ceremony, a ritual designed to subjugate the two central participants to the superordinate authority of Christ, the Christian hero, and said that this was the way to peace. If all the great kings would bow voluntarily to the figure of the hero, there would be no more reason for war. Every unmapped territory, that is, every place where what to do has not been specified, also constitutes the battleground for ancestral kings. The learned patterns of action and interpretation that vie for application when a new situation arises can be usefully regarded, metaphorically, as the current embodiments of adaptive strategies formulated as a consequence of past exploratory behavior, as adaptive strategies invented and constructed by the heroes of the past, unconsciously mimicked and duplicated by those currently alive. Adaptation to new territory, that is, to the unexpected, therefore also means successful mediation of archaic or habitual strategies competing in the new situation for dominance over behavioral output. Rank ordering of these warring strategies, construction of a context-specific behavioral dominance hierarchy, which corresponds to the nested narrative model proposed earlier, therefore constitutes adaptation, just as much as creation of new, situation-specific behaviors or modes of interpretation, which are inevitably composed anyway of bits and pieces of the past. The process of exploration, including its assimilative and accommodative aspects, is therefore inevitably entangled with the process of peacemaking. Exploration, in a given situation, can hardly be regarded as complete until the tendencies and theories that struggle for predominance in that situation have been organized to make internal or externalized conflict and emotional upheaval cease. The exploratory hero, mankind's savior, cuts the primordial chaos into pieces and makes the world, rescues his dead father from the underworld and revivifies him, and organizes the nobles occupying his kingdom into an effective, flexible, and dynamic hierarchy. There is no categorical difference between the individual who explores and the individual who reconstructs society as a consequence of that exploration. Accommodation to new information is an integral part of the exploratory process. An anomaly has not been processed until the pre-existent interpretive schemas extant prior to its emergence have been reconfigured to take its presence into account. Every explorer is, therefore, by necessity, a revolutionary, and every successful revolutionary is a peacemaker. We act appropriately before we understand how we act, just as children learn to behave before they can describe the reasons for their behavior. It is only through the observation of our actions, accumulated and distilled over centuries, that we come to understand our own motivations and the patterns of behavior that characterize our cultures. And these are changing as we model them. Active adaptation precedes abstracted comprehension of the basis for such adaptation. This is necessarily the case because we are more complex than we can understand, as is the world to which we must adjust ourselves. First, we act. Afterward, we envision the pattern that constitutes our actions. Then we use that pattern to guide our actions. It is establishment of conscious, declarative connection between behavior and consequences of that behavior, which means establishment of a new feedback process that enables us to abstractly posit a desired future, to act in such a way as to bring that future about, and to judge the relevance of emergent phenomena themselves on the basis of their apparent relevance to that future. This ability appears to be predicated on some developmental leap, at least insofar as the guiding story has become conscious or represented in episodic or semantic memory, as opposed to remaining implicitly embedded in behavior, and appears unlikely to characterize very young children, or animals for that matter. The developmental psychologist Jean Piaget solved the problem of the goal-like behavior in creatures not yet capable of abstract conceptualization by presuming that goals are initially embedded in sensory-motor reflex operations which are instinctive. This essentially means that what is later story is at first pattern, the pattern of socially modified behavior that constitutes human being. It is only later, as higher order, episodic or semantic cognitive systems become activated, that goals become explicitly imagined and that they can be considered abstractly before their inaction. So, this means that it is possible to act in a manner that looks as if it were goal-directed before goals as such have manifested themselves. The psychologist Joseph Reichlach describes Piaget's observation. Quote, children do not appear to be logicians at birth, conceptually interacting by constructing schema from the outset. The initial constructions are being done biologically, and only at some time later does the child schematize the reflexive patterns already underway. End quote. First comes the action pattern, guided by instinct, shaped without conscious realization by the consequences of socially mediated rewards and punishments, determined in their structure and locale by the current social mores, products of historical forces. Then comes the capacity to to imagine the end toward which behavior should be directed. Information generated from the observation of behavior provides the basis for constructing fantasies about such ends. Actions that satisfy emotions have a pattern. Abstraction allows us to represent and duplicate that pattern as an end. The highest level abstractions therefore allow us to represent the most universally applicable behavioral pattern, that characterizing the hero, who eternally turns the unknown into something secure and beneficial, who eternally reconstructs the secure and beneficial when it has degenerated into tyranny. The myth of the hero has come to represent the essential nature of human possibility as manifested in adaptive behavior as a consequence of observation and re-representation of such behavior, conducted cumulatively over the course of thousands of years. The hero myth provides the structure that governs, but does not determine, the general course of history, expresses one fundamental preconception in a thousand different ways. This idea, analogous in structure to the modern hypothesis, although not explicitly formulated nor rationally constructed in the same manner, renders individual creativity socially acceptable and provides the precondition for change. The most fundamental presumption of the myth of the hero is that the nature of human experience can be, should be, improved by voluntary alteration in individual human attitude and action. This statement, the historical hypothesis, is an expression of faith in human possibility itself and constitutes the truly revolutionary idea of historical man. All specific adaptive behaviors, which are acts that restrict the destructive or enhance the beneficial potential of the unknown, follow a general pattern. This pattern, which at least produces the results intended and therefore desired, inevitably attracts social interest. Interesting or admirable behaviors engender imitation and description. Such imitation and description might first be of an interesting or admirable behavior, but is later of the class of interesting and admirable behaviors. The class is then imitated as a general guide to specific actions, is re-described, redistilled, and imitated once again. The image of the hero, step by step, becomes ever clearer and ever more broadly applicable. The pattern of behavior characteristic of the hero, that is, voluntary advance in the face of the dangerous and promising unknown, generation of something of value as a consequence, and, simultaneously, dissolution and reconstruction of current knowledge, of current morality, comes to form the kernel for the good story, cross-culturally. That story, which is what to do when you no longer know what to do, defines the central pattern of behavior embedded in all genuinely religious systems. Furthermore, provides the basis for the respect due the individual undergirding our conception of natural rights. Representations of the Ouroboros, the dragon of chaos, and his daughter, the Great Mother, are symbolic portrayals of the unknown. Mythological representation of the hero and his cultural construction are, by contrast, examination and portrayal of who or what it is that knows and of what it is that is known. The creative and destructive feminine is the personality manifested in mythology by everything unknown, threatening, and promising about and within existence. Myth tends to portray the generative individual consciousness eternally willing to face this unknown power as masculine in essence, in contradistinction to unconscious, impersonal, and unpredictable femininity, and in light of its seminal, active, fructifying nature. The earliest stages of the development of the figure of the hero take the form of mythic representations of the infant or adolescent, fully or partially dominated by potent maternal force. This infant or adolescent is the specific individual under the sway of the particular mother. And Homo sapiens, the species, subject to nature. Generative individual consciousness, as eternal son of the virginal mother, is represented in figure